Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What images do we associate with the global war on terror? And how do those mental pictures play into our feelings about the conflict, its relative righteousness, and the dangers it poses to us and to our enemies? W.J.T. Mitchell is Gaylord Donnelly Distinguished Professor in the Department of English Language and Literature, the Department of Art History, and the College at the University of Chicago. He writes about the ways image-making and war-making have been transformed over the past decade in his new book, Cloning Terror, The War of Images, 9/11 to the Present. Tom, welcome to Think.
Nice to be with you.
You write here that regarding any historic event, there is the story of what happened, and then there is the story of the perception of what happened. How different are those two stories as applied? We'll start with the 9/11 attacks and all that's come afterward.
Well, there's always a conflict between what actually happened and the story of what happened. For one thing, what happened is usually a fairly singular, determinate thing. The versions, the stories of it, are multiple and often in dispute. That's why historians almost never agree about anything. 9/11 was taken by many people as the trauma of the century for the U.S. and for the whole world. If you look at it from an international perspective, many people said, yes, it's a bit terrible event, but it doesn't compare at all with what's happening, say, in Pakistan now, or with the tsunami. Other kinds of attacks have been much worse, and so there was a tendency to exaggerate it and to turn it into a kind of pretext for waging a world war, a war, as I've argued, that has no determinate objective, that is against a phantom enemy, that is unlocatable, on fronts that are undefinable.
It's really interesting in that regard because this is a war that is being fought by our military as opposed to the more symbolic wars on things like drugs and on poverty. But in some ways, you find that it has more in common with those metaphoric wars.
Yes. We've had metaphoric wars of that sort since the 19th century. I think the first one was the war on tuberculosis. But everybody understood that those were metaphoric wars. That is, we didn't bomb tuberculars and when we had a war on drugs, we did not bomb drug dealers, although there has been some militarization of that metaphor, especially in Latin America. The war on poverty did not involve, generally, bombing poor neighborhoods. But the war on terror was taken literally, and in fact, there was a debate about it early on. Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, and George Bush himself all said, no, it's not a metaphor. We mean it seriously. We mean it literally. And, of course, they did. So it's one of those cases where an imaginary conception, a metaphorical conception, is made literal by brute force and with the consequences we see today.
So is the war on terror, do you think, merely symbolized by what's going on with the U.S. military in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Merely symbolized? I don't think it's merely symbolized. I mean, it becomes very actual.
Yeah.
But it has continually been justified as part of the necessary tactics, the necessary real-world measures that follow from the idea that we are at war with terror. If you think about the phrase, war on terror, it's a complete oxymoron. It makes as much sense as having a war on nervousness or anxiety. So having a war on terror still nevertheless frames actual practical activity, like the invasion and occupation of a major Middle Eastern country. In fact, now two Middle Eastern countries. So again, it's the way a fantasy gets literalized and seems very difficult to bring to an end, even though the Obama administration has quietly retired the phrase war on terror and replaced it with a euphemism, overseas contingency operations. The war continues. It's as if the metaphor or the image of this holy war against this nebulous enemy has faded into the background, but it's constantly reactivated whenever politicians need to justify the continuation of these wars.
So we should talk about this other word that's in your title and threaded throughout the book, and that is cloning. Scientifically, this refers to the ability to create exact genetic copies of something that is or was alive. And as you remind us, immediately before the attacks on the Pentagon and on the World Trade Center, scientific cloning was, in fact, the dominant news story.
It was. Karl Rove and George W. Bush settled on the debate over cloning as the central issue of the first year of their administration. It was driven off the front pages, of course, by the 9/11 attacks. But if you had looked at the newspapers in August of 2001, almost every day there was a headline concerning this, what I call the clone wars, the debate over stem cell research and biotechnology. On 9/11, in fact, if you look at the New York Times for that day, the headline has to do with the National Academy of Sciences recommending that cloning be allowed to go forward, that stem cell research not be restricted to existing lines. So these two debates, the debate over terror and what the proper means for it, for dealing with it are, whether war or some other alternative, and the debate over cloning, they were adjacent in time, coincidental almost, and they continued to interact in a lot of the political rhetoric in the subsequent years.
Why do we find the concept of scientific cloning so disquieting?
It's a great question. It is, I think, partly a faith-based notion of what the limits of science should be. As you probably know, probably a majority of Americans don't believe in evolution. They're deeply suspicious of biotechnology. And the idea of making a living copy of a living thing, you just read the definition a moment ago, that idea, to some people, sounds like playing God. Mm-hmm. God alone is supposed to have the secret of life. So stem cell researchers, people who engage in the artificial reproduction of life forms, are seen as impious, as playing God, meddling with the natural order of things. So there is something disquieting about the whole notion that we could create artificial life. Of course, we've been doing it. Cloning is a very old word and goes back to the Greek word for grafting. It involves ancient practices of genetic manipulation of plants. But it's only in our time, only in really the 21st century, late 20th century, that the cloning of animals, and specifically mammals, has become possible. So it is a drastic innovation in our time, and needless to say, it raises all kinds of concerns. And so that's why it was taken as a central wedge issue by the Bush administration to try to divide the electorate and produce a majority against this kind of science.
How interesting, though, Tom, that we're uncomfortable with the idea of playing God with the potential to give life, but taking lives as we would in a war doesn't seem to bother Americans as much.
That's very well put. I couldn't agree more. And it is striking that the production of life, the enhancement of life, and most of the scientists, 99% of the scientists involved in cloning, are doing it for therapeutic purposes. They want to find ways of regenerating nerve tissue, damaged bodily tissues of all kinds, for therapeutic purposes. They have no interest in reproducing identical twins of people, which is basically what cloning would be. For one thing, it's a very dicey proposition. Even when done with sheep, the consequences were not always very positive. There are a lot of failure involved. So reproductive cloning is one thing. Therapeutic cloning is quite another. And my own position on this is I say yes to therapeutic cloning. I think reproductive cloning ought to be looked upon with a lot of skepticism and restricted.
What relationship does our fear of cloning have to our fear of icons and images?
Well, a clone is an icon in a couple of senses. First, the idea that it is a copy of a living thing, and it's a living copy of a living thing. That's what makes it new. The idea that now we can not just make copies of living things like pictures, photographs, movies, images of life. That's a very old idea, the idea of making an image which is lifelike or lively. But the idea that the image itself would come alive, that's associated with this process of cloning. Prior to our time, that is the 21st century, the idea of making a living copy was mythical. It was a phantasm. It was usually reserved for God himself. The creation of Adam from the clay of the ground and breathing life into that sculpted object, usually described as a vessel or a jar, that was the myth of creating a living image of a living thing, that is, an image of God. So as you can see, there's a whole theological kind of history behind the phobia about cloning and the idea of it as an image. Man and woman are supposed to be created in the image of God. They are living images. So in some sense, the whole idea of cloning was invented at the beginning when the first living image was made. But in our time, it's moved into the scientific laboratory. The idea that you could produce a living thing in the lab, which was only science fiction up until a few years ago, is now a real possibility.
Talk for a minute about the images that we associate with the war on terror.
Well, there's many of them. Probably the launching image, the one that was the traumatic image that made an impression on the world, and especially on the U.S., was, of course, the destruction of the Twin Towers themselves. Towers which, by the way, were often described as architectural clones because they were faceless and identical. So that those scenes of destruction, the indelible memory of the airplanes striking the World Trade Towers, that became engraved as an impression on the consciousness of, I think, just about every American. And, of course, it was reproduced, replicated, appropriated innumerable times, always with the imperative, remember this icon of the terrible attack on America. And it was used repeatedly to justify attacks on other countries, most notably, of course, Iraq, which, as we now know, without any question, had nothing to do with 9/11, nothing to do with al-Qaeda, and, of course, didn't have any weapons of mass destruction. This is why I call the war on terror, insofar as it became real, it is still predicated on a fantasy. But that's the first kind of iconic form that I would associate with the war on terror, and that's the what's sometimes called the casus belli, the thing that leads to the war, and that was the attack on the World Trade Centers, an attack which didn't merely destroy them, but produced an image of destruction. This is the interesting thing about this process of image destruction.
Let me have you stop right there. We're going to take a quick break. W.J.T. Mitchell is my guest. He joins us from the University of Chicago. His new book is called Cloning Terror, The War of Images, 9/11 to the Present. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is W.J.T. Mitchell, Gaylord Donnelly Distinguished Service Professor in the Department of English Language and Literature, the Department of Art History, and the College at the University of Chicago. His new book is called Cloning Terror, The War of Images, 9/11 to the Present. You can be part of the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. We had to take a break, Tom, when you were talking about the destruction of images and the images of destruction from the collapse of the Twin Towers. Why don't you finish your thought there?
Sure. It's of course, everybody understands what it means to destroy an image. And if the World Trade Towers were already an icon before their destruction, an icon of modernity, of global capitalism. They were the World Trade Center, of course, and this was not the first attack on them. They were regarded as symbolic of U.S. dominance of the world economy and politics, and the other target was the Pentagon. So military targets are not just strategic military objects. They're often icons. You try to take down the emblem of the enemy, their flag, their capital. The image of their leader is often defaced and disfigured. So the World Trade Center was a predictable target for terrorists. And the idea of the destruction of an image, though, is that it should not take place in private or secret or be hidden. It should be public and should be, if possible, a spectacle that is telecast worldwide. And that's what made the destruction of the World Trade Center so traumatic. It was not just the destruction of a building, but the production of an image of destruction that circulated globally.
And how does the speed with which those images are transmitted in the modern world, or cloned, if you will, how does that affect how much power they have over us?
I think it means they have a lot more power. They act much more quickly, but it also means sometimes their power can be incalculable. For instance, another, you asked about other images of the war on terror. The photo opportunities that were staged by the Bush administration to mark victorious moments, I think particularly of the moment when the mission accomplished photo was produced on the deck of the aircraft carrier Lincoln, and George W. Bush landed on the aircraft carrier in a flight suit and announced mission accomplished. That photo opportunity, which he hoped to that it would have an effect rather like the Mount Suribachi photo in World War II, that is, be an image of victory, turned out to be an image of embarrassment. The Bush administration had to disavow that they had anything to do with it. It was ridiculed widely, and the idea that the mission was accomplished on that day in 2003 has been, repeatedly treated as a joke. So the images circulate much more rapidly. That means they do have more power, but the power itself is unpredictable, hard to control. And that's why at the center of my book, probably the most important images of the war on terror are those that emerged from the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. The whole repertoire of images of torture victims, naked Iraqis stacked in piles, forced to simulate sex acts, and most notably a single image that emerged as the emblem of the entire invasion of Iraq and of the war on terror, and that's the hooded man of Abu Ghraib, which is the cover image of my book, and which must have been cloned a million times around the world, transformed into a whole variety of other images, but always with the memory of this this moment when the meaning of the war on terror was exposed. The last kind of alibi for it, that there was a liberation of Iraq going on, was pretty much undercut by the appearance of these torture images. And that one played the kind of centerpiece of the whole whole Abu Ghraib scandal.
Well, the hooded man figure is haunting for a number of reasons, not least of which, as you point out, for many people, it bears a certain resemblance to the image of the crucified Jesus.
Yes, it does. It's really uncanny because it was not a professional photograph. It was taken by a couple of GIs, purely accidental that it appeared that way. Although one has to say that the position of the Iraqi standing on a box with a hood on his head was no accident. It's called the Jesus position among the torture and intelligence interrogator community. So it's a common thing. But this photograph, the particular pose that the man assumed with his arms spread out, wearing the black cloak, did remind a lot of people of the images from the Passion of the Christ. So this gave the image legs, as they say in advertising. It just kept on going. And part of my book is just an effort to see where it went. It went all over the Arab world, of course. It was had an electrifying effect of mobilizing more jihadists. It was probably the greatest recruiting tool for terrorism that the U.S. has ever created.
You include another, I guess it's a political cartoon in the book, and it's someone saying, "I want you to invade Iraq." Can you talk a little bit about that image?
Yes. Do you remember who that is that wants us to invade Iraq?
It's Osama bin Laden.
That's right. And he is in the position of Uncle Sam.
Right.
We can call him now Uncle Osama. And
he's got the beard like the Uncle Sam traditional pictures.
Right, yeah. He's a direct parody of the Uncle Sam recruiting poster. There he is with his finger pointing at you and saying, "I want you to invade Iraq." Now, you might ask, well, why does Osama bin Laden, why should he want to have the U.S. invade Iraq? After all, isn't the whole point of Al-Qaeda to try to get the U.S. out of the Middle East? That's their stated agenda. Actually, as Richard Clark, the head of counterinsurgency, pointed out in his wonderful book, Against All Enemies, this was Osama bin Laden's actual strategy. The attack on 9/11 was designed to lure the U.S. into invading and occupying a Middle Eastern country, most likely Iraq. The theory was that this invasion would mobilize the entire Arab world against the U.S., that it would discredit the U.S. morally and politically throughout the Middle East, and that it would have the classical effect of warfare, that is, you tie down the enemy in an endless and unwinnable war. So he wastes his resources, spends billions and billions of dollars, and loses thousands of men in combat, and accomplishes nothing. That's a classic strategy of war. The weaker enemy, as Clausewitz says, the only way they can win is to lure the stronger enemy into wasting their resources. And that's exactly what Osama bin Laden did. So the recruiting poster captures all that in a single image. Osama was recruiting us to invade Iraq, and we walked right into it.
It also occurred to me, Tom, reading this book, that I think most Americans can call up in their heads the image of Saddam Hussein emerging bearded and haggard from the spider hole. But somehow that doesn't seem to have the same hold on us that we have every time a sort of badly shot videotape of Osama bin Laden shows up.
Yes. Saddam Hussein he was promoted, I think, as a substitute image for Osama bin Laden. This has always puzzled me. Maybe some of your callers will have an idea about it. Donald Rumsfeld gave the most cogent argument I can think of for replacing Osama bin Laden as the iconic enemy with Saddam Hussein. He said, it's because there's nothing to bomb in Afghanistan. It's not a target-rich environment. Whereas we can go after a head of state, Saddam Hussein, in Iraq, and he's got statues everywhere. They can be pulled down, and they were, of course, producing lots of images of, quote, victory. There were many photo ops of the destruction of Saddam Hussein's monuments, buildings, and statues. But I think you're right. The way Saddam Hussein ended his days, first with the capture and the dental examination, these images were humiliating. They revealed him to be just a scruffy guy with bad teeth. And so the formidable enemy was no longer there. I think in some ways represents the way the war in Iraq has not ended, but petered out. Osama bin Laden, on the other hand, survives as a kind of phantasmatic figure, still out there, still recruiting us to engage in a war on terror, which we're doing. I mean, the next front is Pakistan itself. We're trying to get across the border there. Pakistanis are very worried about that. And there's a lot of talk about Yemen. After all, there's Al-Qaeda cells in Yemen. Why not invade it? And then, of course, the big target, Iran, which anybody who is an expert in the Middle East will tell you, Iran has nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. They absolutely despise them. But to most Americans, the difference between Iran and Iraq is just one letter. And why not? If they're defined as the enemy, as sponsors of terror, then they are fair game. This is no way to run a world.
Do you think the war on terror, as fought by the United States, deliberately or accidentally cultivates fear?
I think it's a combination of the two. I think it was Stephen Colbert, in his great appearance on the Mall in Washington last fall. He entitled his speech to the gathered thousands of people, "Keep Fear Alive." Keep fear alive, making fun of Jesse Jackson's Keep Hope Alive. So I think the cultivation of terror as this phantasmatic enemy, that you must not question our government because, after all, they're protecting us from this terrible, invisible menace. I think that was deliberately cultivated. And I think it's still being cultivated as an excuse for an ongoing state of emergency, suspension of civil liberties, absolute government power to snoop into your email and your telephone calls. I just read in the New York Times this morning, even to speak about terrorism or terrorists in any way which is skeptical of their absolute evil can be construed as a crime. The Roberts Supreme Court has ruled that it counts as aid and comfort to the enemy. This is a direct restraint of free speech. I don't expect that your radio program is being monitored by the CIA right now or I'll be hauled in, but this is the kind of thinking. When you cultivate fear in this way, you make people say, well, the government has to do something about it, and it does give the government and its agencies a lot more power than they should have. So I think that's the positive answer to your question on one side, that the fear was deliberately cultivated. I also think that there is a realistic part of fear, that the U.S. does have actual enemies, and that we should try to understand those enemies and figure out better ways to combat them. But the destruction of the U.S. Constitution strikes me as the wrong way to go about it.
Well, it's interesting to compare the way we're doing things now and have been doing them for the past, you know, 9 years or so, with the famous quote by FDR saying, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself." And as you point out in the book, we absolutely had plenty to fear at the time he made that statement, but that wasn't what he chose to dwell on.
Yeah, and I think Colbert's "Keep Fear Alive" is kind of the obverse of FDR's wonderful statement. The key thing, I think, about a democracy is that it must operate its foreign policy out of rational concerns, provable anxieties, well-founded assessments of dangers, but it mustn't allow political mania and the the conjuring up of phantoms of terror to dictate foreign policy, as it did throughout the Bush era. And although I very much supported Obama, I'm afraid that the momentum of that era has carried over into our time, and the same recorded messages drone on every day at the airport, announcing that Homeland Security has raised the alert level to orange in this ominous voice, and urging us all to be vigilant and alert. I always ask myself when I'm at the airport, well, what does this mean? The effect, I think, on people is just to kind of heighten the anxiety level, and people go, look at each other suspiciously, I suppose. And if there's somebody wearing a keffiyeh or who looks Middle Eastern, their temperature goes up slightly. This is not the way to run a democracy.
I think I heard recently that they've talked about doing away with the color-coded system. But I'm wondering what you thought, as a person who studies images, of the way that was all done, with the red and the green and the orange and the yellow. And does that sort of symbolize, does it crystallize a decade in American history, do you think?
It's very funny because at the time that the color-coded system was first introduced, I was interviewed by Los Angeles NPR about it. They said, what do you think? And this gives me a chance to tell the joke I should have told then, which is the color-coded system doesn't have enough colors in it. We need to have code pink. And, you know, the danger that homosexuals might be at the airport. After all, you know, maybe we should require homosexuals not to to tell, and we shouldn't ask them, but we should just remain in a state of anxiety.
We should point out you are speaking in jest here.
I thought the color-coded system was like laughable. It was, especially since it was this constant recording, and it never varied. Have you ever heard it ever announced as today? The alert level is green. Relax.
Don't worry. Yeah. WJT Mitchell is my guest. His new book is called Cloning Terror, The War of Images, 9/11 to the Present. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is WJT Mitchell. He is professor of English language and literature and art history at the University of Chicago. His new book is called Cloning Terror, The War of Images, 9/11 to the Present. Join us at 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we hear from Mark in Fort Worth. Hi, Mark.
Hello. Just a quick comment. I find the guest's comments really absurd. Based on the fact that several would-be bombers have made efforts to detonate bombs and have been captured in FBI sting operations. And in addition to that, our service people are being killed on almost a daily basis by real bombs that are planted in roadside areas and, killed by bullets from terrorists. So I find his comments absurd and not based in reality.
Well, I'm glad you called, Mark. Let's get a response for you. Do you want to answer that, Tom?
Yes. Sorry if I'm absurd. I think our soldiers are being shot in Afghanistan and in Iraq and blown up by improvised explosive devices. I would never deny that. Absolutely clear that it's happening. The question is, why are they there? What are they there for? What is the aim of their being there? And the framework of that war, the strategic framework, is the war on terror. The idea is they are supposed to be keeping us safe, you safe in Dallas, and me safe in Chicago. And I think that is the proposition that's absurd. Nothing absurd about the actual death and dying on both sides. That's terrible. As for the people who've been captured in FBI stings, I'm very happy when they intercept somebody who wants to plant a bomb. My quarrel is not with the reality of the fact of terrorist cells, of people who want to plant bombs. That's a fact. You're absolutely right. My quarrel is with the notion that by invading and occupying foreign countries in the Middle East, we somehow bring that to a halt. In fact, all the national intelligence estimates since the early part of the last decade have indicated that our attacks and our invasion and occupation of other countries have made the threat of terrorism much worse, that there are many more terrorist cells, that in fact we're pouring gasoline on the flames. And it's our servicemen who pay the price of that. We pay it through, of course, the incredible cost of these wars, but they pay with their bodies. And I totally sympathize. If you took me to mean that that's not really happening, that would be absurd, but that's not what I was saying.
Of course, there are people who will argue back at the same time that in fact, we weren't occupying a foreign country at the time of the 9/11 attacks. And since they have happened, there has not been another major attack on U.S. soil. And some people see that as a sign that we've done the right things.
Yes, and I recognize that argument. I think it's we've been very lucky to head off attacks. I also think it indicates that the indigenous sleeper cells, the possibility of jihadists or terrorists in this country mustering a serious attack is relatively small, that they are not nearly as strong as we've imagined them to be. That's not true, I think, in Europe. The Madrid bombings, the Glasgow bombings, the London subway bombings, I think the Muslim population in the U.S. is relatively well assimilated and is happy to be in this country. And whenever people go out on a kind of crusade against them, I think it's a huge mistake. That, unfortunately, has been happening in Europe, where pundits are talking about a new Moorish invasion, and where second-generation Pakistanis living in Sheffield or Leeds decide to take up arms because they think their Arab brothers are being murdered in the Middle East. So it's uneven. I think Al-Qaeda is non-existent in the U.S. except for a few people who get stirred up by the Internet. In Europe, quite a different story.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. This time we'll speak with Jeff in Dallas. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks.
This is a fascinating subject because you're saying things I've been saying for quite a while, and I have a big concern, and that is, how do we defend ourselves from this exploitation of iconography by corporate interests, by government, and so on? And specifically, I will point out that it's shown that art and music teach critical thinking skills. I expand the brain in those areas. They're cut out of the public schools, but, you know, they're not cut out of the elite private schools. And I just have to wonder if we aren't heading down a path where the intention is to have an ultra-wealthy ruling class and everyone else will be serfs on corporate plantations who will do the bidding of the people who control this kind of symbolism. And, you know, and I see the fact that we no longer have a draft, a universal draft, so that the children of these elites don't have to fight the wars as part of the problem.
What do you think, Tom?
Well, actually, I couldn't agree more, Jeff. I am alarmed about the decline of the humanities, that is, teaching literature, critical thought, teaching art, and what I teach, media, of course, and I'm teaching at one of those elite private schools, University of Chicago. But I think one of the main fronts in whatever kind of war we're having at the present time is education, that we've got to restore the idea of democratic education, where every American citizen gets a first-class education in art, literature, and critical thinking, so that they're not manipulated by these kind of images, as you point out.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Jim in Dallas. Hi, Jim.
Hi, dear. By the way, in response to the guy who just called, the elite have never had to go to war, George Bush being an example of that. But the thing I wanted to ask you to address is this whole issue is one about the influence of demagogues within the political system. And if the icons and images are controlled by demagogues, they get to address them as their own, and it becomes the fodder for bigotry, as we see it in this country. It exists on every level, and I just wish you to just address this issue of demagogues.
Thanks for your call.
I think he's absolutely right that demagoguery with modern media has never been more alive and well. I'm afraid that probably not as many people are listening to this broadcast as are listening to Rush Limbaugh right about now, or to Fox News, which proliferates fantasy, outright falsehoods, creates narratives that are totally at variance with the facts. As Keith Olbermann has put it, everybody has a right to their opinion. That's fine. But not everybody has a right to their facts. And the production of falsehood, of fantasies of terrible enemies at our gates, has really been quite painful for our political culture and for, I think, ultimately our Constitution. The country is in considerable peril from demagoguery. It brought down the Athenian democracy in the age of Pericles. The demagogues arose, and it's the great danger of democracy that a kind of irresponsible and power-hungry form of speech and communication and image-making will come to dominate, especially when it's allied with great wealth and has a lot of power to make its views known.
So what can we learn, Tom, from the times when the images created by those in power go awry and stray from their original messages? I'm thinking, once again, of the mission accomplished image or of the Abu Ghraib photos, which leaked out and over time really fermented into something very different from what the people who took those pictures might have intended.
Well, I think that's an inevitable part of the life of images. As I've been saying, images are like life forms. They're difficult to control, and they often backfire against their producers. So I think my own mission as a scholar, as an iconologist, a student who watches the images, traces their patterns of growth and circulation, is to bring critical thought to bear on these images and to show the reversals of meaning, the ways in which they get out of the control of their producers. Certainly the Abu Ghraib photographs, every possible effort was made to suppress them. The army tried to keep them under wraps. If those photographs did not exist, in effect, Abu Ghraib would not exist, and Guantanamo Bay would not be an issue. But we know that those photographs were produced out of an effort to Gitmoize Abu Ghraib, that is to take the same techniques, as they call them, what George W. Bush called enhanced interrogation techniques, and to transfer them to Abu Ghraib with the results we've seen. So those images, once the cat is out of the bag, I think it's important. Artists, scholars, writers, critics have to grab hold of those images and try to enhance their power to produce critical thinking and not just the behavior of sheep following behind some standard.
I'm curious about your experience as a professor. Young people today have been raised to be so suspicious of marketing and advertising, and they're always sort of trying to read behind whatever the front text is in terms of people trying to sell them things. Are they as critical when they come to news and information?
You know, that's a great question. I am not sure. I think my students certainly are. I can count on that. But then I have a highly selected student body at University of Chicago, probably somewhat like the student body at SMU, where they come well-educated already, well-prepared in general, and open to the possibility of having their opinions challenged, being exposed to different ideas. But I'm afraid the earlier caller who talked about the decline of our democratic education system, the assault on the public education system, I'm not so sure we can count on people who don't read newspapers, who don't read magazines and are not exposed to critical thought, who spend most of their time either playing video games, watching television, or I don't know what. So clearly an increasing number of people in this country are in that latter category, and that's very alarming for democracy. Jefferson, all the founding fathers, I love the way the Tea Party invokes them. The key to American democracy was to have an educated, critical electorate and not to have a nation of sheep who could be led astray by lies and propaganda and demagoguery.
Is it your sense that the era of the war on terror ended with the election of Barack Obama?
I wish I could say yes, but I can't. At the level of imagery, at the level of symbolism, it did end because Barack Obama ran as the anti-war candidate. In fact, I think much of his support nationally came from those who felt that the war in Iraq was a mistake. And that, of course, by 2004 and 5, as the futility of the war became clear, that really did become an issue that a majority of Americans agreed on. They might not agree on everything else, but they knew that Iraq was a mistake. So Obama's election was symbolically a statement by the American people, we want the war in Iraq to end. The war on terror, I'm not so sure. The war on terror, you see, is the global strategic framework of which Iraq is just one part. So even though Obama promised to and has reduced our commitment in Iraq.
You know, I'm so sorry to cut you off here, but we are out of time.
Oh, sorry.
That's quite all right. The new book by W.J.T. Mitchell is called Cloning Terror, The War of Images, 9/11 to the Present. Tom, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, Chris. It went too fast.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.